From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Soon, you can buy a 3D printer, download a blueprint for a pistol or even an AR-15, and print the weapon in the privacy of your own home. A recent legal settlement has led to a new era of do-it-yourself weaponry. Just about anyone with an internet connection and a few thousand dollars to spare can buy the equipment, download the specs, and make their own guns. The settlement raises big questions about the right to bear arms, free speech, and the future of gun control. This hour on Point, the right to bear 3D printed weapons. You can join us on air or online. Have you used 3D printing technology to make a gun? Do you plan to do so starting August 1st? Or does the idea scare you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me from New York now is Andy Greenberg. He's a senior writer for Wired, who covers security, privacy, information freedom, and hacker culture. He's been following this story since 2013, and you can find a link to his piece headlined, "A Landmark Legal Shift Opens Pandora's Box for DIY Guns." That's on our website at onpointradio.org. Andy Greenberg, great to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks, Anthony.
So let's back up and bring our listeners sort of up to date. This involves the founder of a company called Defense Distributed. The founder is Cody Wilson. Tell us about Defense Distributed and Cody Wilson's effort to get this legal settlement.
Well, Cody is a radical libertarian, or you could call him an anarchist. He is a extreme gun rights advocate. I would say Defense Distributed, it isn't technically a company, but it functions more as a kind of almost nonprofit advocacy group, or a technology sort of think tank almost. They definitely are not just trying to make money here. Their goal from their founding has been to allow anyone anywhere in the world to create a gun at home with zero gun control, by whatever means necessary. But they're clearly most focused on these new means of digital fabrication, these kind of newfangled tools like 3D printers and CNC milling machines. That stands for computer numerical controlled milling machines. These are like computer controlled kind of drills that move in three dimensions and can carve metal objects.
Right.
So similarly, you can use those along with 3D printers to create weapons at home. And that is the kind of project that Defense Distributed has been advancing now for 5 years.
Right. And we should say, Cody Wilson, founder of Defense Distributed, had agreed yesterday to be on our program today, right now. Unfortunately, he hasn't called in and we haven't been able to reach him. So we're sorry about that, but he may be joining us later in the hour. Maybe he won't be. We'll see. But Andy Greenberg, we're happy to have you because you really put this story in front of us. So the key thing, if I have this right, that Cody Wilson is doing is essentially posting downloadable specs to make these guns with a 3D printer. So back up a little. Do I have that right?
Well, the story kind of begins earlier than that. Cody Wilson and Defense Distributed not only wanted to share files to make 3D printable guns, they invented the first fully 3D printable gun. Starting in 2012, they started to work on this, on the actual experimentation of creating a gun that is fully plastic that can be made in a 3D printer, down to its barrel, its trigger, everything. And when they succeeded at that in 2013, in May of 2013, they announced that they had successfully created the first 3D printed gun. They called it the Liberator, and I was there when Cody test fired it for the first time. And when it worked, their intention was to share it with the world, to put this file online so that anyone, as scary as this might sound, can download that file, click print on their 3D printer, and create a gun in their garage or wherever they are.
Right.
With zero oversight.
So back up and explain to us the Obama-era policy about this and how the Justice Department of the Obama era responded to Cody Wilson putting these specs online and making them downloadable for everybody.
So you don't actually have to back up, because as soon as they had uploaded these files onto their website, the Obama-era State Department sent Cody Wilson a letter threatening him with prosecution if he left these files online. They were basically making the argument that he had violated ITAR, which stands for the International Traffic in Arms Regulation. It's basically export controls. So you're not allowed to simply ship whatever weapons you want internationally. And the State Department at the time was arguing that by uploading this digital file to the, you know, international internet that's accessible everywhere, it was as if Defense Distributed had shipped their plastic weapon to, you know, Mexico or Iran or whatever. And so Defense Distributed was, you know, facing really severe legal repercussions. Cody Wilson could have gone to prison for this if he didn't comply, and he did. He took the files down. But he immediately began planning. Cody Wilson is, in fact, a former law student who dropped out of law school to do this. And he immediately began planning a kind of legal retaliation, and in 2015 finally launched a lawsuit against the State Department, claiming, you know, kind of interestingly, a First Amendment right to publish these files.
See, this is fascinating, because you'd think we would be talking about a Second Amendment right to produce and bear arms. But he argued on First Amendment grounds as well, right? Can you explain that?
That's right, yeah. So, you know, Defense Distributed's kind of, you know, deviously brilliant thing that they did was to blur this line between the physical and the digital. Like a physical gun becomes this digital file. And then, you know, once you've done that, it, you know, code is a kind of speech. That's been established in other cases. So they made the argument that these blueprints are protected under free speech. So in essence, they kind of have blurred the First Amendment's protections of free speech with the Second Amendment's protection of the right to bear arms. And they argue that case and took it really all the way to the Supreme Court for years. The Supreme Court denied the case, did not agree to take it, and sent it back to a district court. But ultimately, before it even reached the court to hear real arguments on that First Amendment, on those First Amendment grounds, the Trump-era Department of Justice essentially gave in and settled the case and gave Defense Distributed everything it wanted, essentially conceded this First Amendment argument.
And why the change in policy? Was there an explanation from the Trump administration?
There was none, no. They did not want to talk to me about this. They didn't really explain anything in the settlement itself. There are a couple kind of competing theories. One is that this ITAR, these export controls, were kind of ripe for, exactly this kind of legal argument to dismantle them, and that there was these export controls were already needed to be reformed, that they were unconstitutional in the first place. Some people have told me that, and that the Obama administration even was pursuing some kind of reform of these export controls. But I've also been told that, you know, the Trump administration just didn't, you know, they're not lovers of gun control, and saw no need to try to fight this uphill battle, and simply, you know, rolled over and conceded, why not, and allowed, essentially, it's not a new precedent, but it is a shift. In fact, the settlement creates a change in the regulations, essentially allowing anyone, but first of all, Defense Distributed, to upload any commercially available, essentially, technical files for guns.
Right. And this obviously has gun control groups very concerned. We're going to be hearing from a representative later in the hour. But for example, the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence says that this settlement could enable terrorists, organized crime syndicates, felons, and domestic abusers all to get quick, easy access to an untraceable gun. There's a lot in that sentence. I mean, clearly one of the key things about this is that these guns are untraceable because they're made at home. You don't have to put a serial number on them, and so they're not traceable.
Well, they're untraceable. They're unregulated. There is no background check, no ID necessary to get one.
Yeah.
In many cases, they're fully plastic. The 3D printed guns can be fully plastic, can be created in a fully plastic form so that they're undetectable by metal detectors as well.
And Andy, you wrote that in your piece, your fascinating piece in Wired about this, that Cody Wilson has declared that gun control would never be the same in an era when anyone can download and print their own firearm. What's your take on what this does to gun control in the United States?
Well, I think it's a kind of landmark that will we're not going to actually see the effects of it immediately. Homemade weapons, just to be clear, are a very small part of the gun control debate in America currently. It's so easy for most people to simply buy a gun, including those who have, carried out mass shootings. But this is going to be a problem for the future as we enter this more kind of futuristic age of everyone having access to cheaper and easier to use digital fabrication tools like these CNC mills and 3D printers that can make guns at home. And that is going to be not just it's not just going to allow anyone to make guns. It specifically allows the people to make guns who can't otherwise buy them, like minors, felons, the mentally ill. And that definitely could become a problem. We've already seen two mass shootings carried out with homemade semi-automatic rifles, both in California, killing five people in each case. And I fear that may be, that may be more to come.
Yeah. Andy, very quickly, before we go to break, I know that you actually downloaded the specs and built your own gun just as a sort of to see what this all was about. Tell me about that experience. How easy was it?
Well, this was a couple of years ago. Defense Distributed, in addition to fighting this legal battle, they actually, their main source of revenue is that they sell this computer-controlled milling machine themselves that they call the Ghost Gunner.
Yeah.
And I used one of those to create a semi-automatic rifle a couple of years ago, and it was pretty easy.
Pretty easy. All right. Andy Greenberg, senior writer for Wired, who covers security, privacy, information freedom, and hacker culture. Stay with us. We're going to continue this conversation after the break. We're talking about downloading and printing guns at home. What do you make of this? You can join the conversation. Would you purchase a 3D printer to create a gun? What do you make of the do-it-yourself gun culture? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hi, I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of the podcast Hidden Brain. This summer, we're sharing a series about reinventing yourself. We call it You 2.0. Add us to your summer listening for ideas about responding to life's messiness and chaos with wisdom.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about when data becomes a matter of free speech and can be used to make guns at home. You can join the conversation. What do you make of the settlement that facilitates the printing of 3D guns? Is this just about gun rights, or do you see access to data and making guns as a First Amendment right as well? My guest today is Andy Greenberg. He's a staff writer for Wired, who has been following this story. Let's listen to a little bit of tape. In 2016, in an interview with Reason TV, which is affiliated with the libertarian magazine Reason, Cody Wilson, founder of Defense Distributed, an online organization that develops and curates digital firearms files, was asked whether he was concerned about members of ISIS downloading blueprints of his weapons.
I just look at the capital stock of guns in this country, more than 300 million. Now there's estimates of 400 to 600 million guns in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look at the nascence of our technology. It's so in its earliest phase. And then I look at how ISIS actually gets its weapons. From federal firearms licensees, sure, but through the direction of the State Department and the CIA and other proxies and affiliates in other countries that are supposedly NATO members. I mean, come on. They're driving this violence. There's no chance that we could ever drive it in a comparable and proportionate way.
And in an interview this year with Michigan-based WNEM-TV5, gun shop owner Glenn Duncan said he sees little distinction between instructions on how to build 3D guns and legally available guidebooks for conventional firearms.
You can go to the library and get a book at the library on how to build a gun, how to build anything. And so are we going to get rid of books?
So with me is Andy Greenberg, senior writer for Wired. Andy, speak to that last point, this idea that the sort of making guns at home culture has been around for a while. And we had someone suggesting there, what do we do? We're going to get rid of all the books that can tell you how to do it. How is this different?
Well, a few points there. You know, I, as we were saying before the break, I have actually done this myself. I'm not a technically skilled guy at all, but I did try as an experiment to create the frame of an AR-15 in 2016 using the traditional manual tools. And it was pretty difficult, and I failed at it, essentially. And then I did also try it with a 3D printer, and I tried it with a computer-controlled milling machine. And those were very simple. The 3D printer was the easiest, but maybe not as durable as the computer-controlled milling machine that, in a matter of hours, created a fully, you know, metal aluminum frame of an AR-15 that had no serial number or any regulation, and I had a completely working AR-15 as a result. So there is a change happening here as well, and I think that the other to respond to the other point in the audio clip you played. These are not manuals. These are blueprints. So, it's not like you're just downloading the anarchist cookbook and following instructions from the kinds of files that Defense Distributed has won the right to upload. You're downloading a file that you then feed into your 3D printer or a CNC milling machine, and it does the work of creating the part or even the entire gun.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. We'd love to know your thoughts about what you make of the do-it-yourself gun culture and this recent change, essentially, in federal law that will allow people like Cody Wilson to put the specs, downloadable specs, up on the website for anyone to download and mill their guns at home. Let's go to Melissa, who's calling from Dyersville, Iowa. Melissa, you're on the air. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. I guess the way I see it, you know, they say that these guns can't be detected by metal detectors. Aren't we opening ourselves up to problems on airplanes, problems in areas that might be considered soft, like sporting events where normally you're not allowed to have weapons?
Melissa, it's a really good question, and Andy Greenberg, I'd love it if you could answer that. These guns can be made of plastic. Presumably they would avoid being detected at an airport, or it would be more difficult to detect them, right?
Well, let me put it in perspective. You know, when Cody Wilson tested the first fully 3D printed gun in 2013, that gun, you know, he actually put a block of metal into it so that it would comply with the Undetectable Firearms Act. You can't actually legally own a fully plastic weapon, a fully plastic gun in America. And that act has now been renewed. So it's illegal to own a plastic gun. And the vast majority of the weapons that people are creating with these kinds of digital fabrication tools are not actually made fully of plastic. The much more realistic practical form of rifle or gun that people are creating is simply creating that one part of the gun, the frame, the lower receiver, mm-hmm. of a handgun or a rifle that is the regulated part, and then you buy everything else online. And none of these sort of other components, you know, things that include the barrel and the stock and everything, all of that is actually completely unregulated. You don't have to go through any gun control or identify yourself to buy it. So the rest of the gun is made of metal. The detectability is only a problem when we're talking about a fully 3D printed gun, and we haven't seen too many models of those, although they do exist, like this, the Liberator that Defense Distributed created in 2013. That was a one-shot pistol that probably is not a practical tool for violence yet, but you know, these things are always evolving.
Sure. Yeah, it represents a kind of prototype that folks could build on, I suppose. Let's go to Laverne, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Laverne, you're on the air. Thanks so much for the call.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I don't think there's going to be more violence because there's more tools. Number one, America's just been violent for years and years and years. And the 3D printer as a disruptor, I think, is a much bigger, interesting discussion. I have a 12-year-old daughter who goes to the Dew Spacer in Omaha and 3D prints all kinds of things. They teach her, have classes and stuff. And they've got like 5 or 6 3D printers in there now. They're just getting smaller and cheaper and more interesting. And I think it's exciting that kids are actually building things again. When I was a child, there was an old man who had a gun shop in his basement, a TV shop in his basement, a mower shop in his basement. I knew tons of people who had, you know, basement little entrepreneurial things where they would fix stuff, you know. And instead of just throwing it out. And so the fact that kids are learning how to build things, I think, is really, really good. Instead of just going, and you can build furniture. I've seen a guy 3D print a house.
Laverne, I want to just jump in and ask you, though. I mean, I take your point about it's nice that people are building things again, but what about the concern? And we're going to hear from this about this later in a moment, actually. What about the concern that more guns, more easily accessible guns, might correlate with more gun violence?
We have had guns. You can pick up guns everywhere. And I mean, there's five guns for every man, woman, and child in Detroit. Children find them in the garbage and on the streets. So the violence in America will not increase because you can 3D print a gun. I mean, you can go stab somebody, beat somebody with a rock, whatever. You know what I'm saying? I just don't feel that we become more violent because we get another tool.
All right.
Either violent or we're not. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, Laverne, I appreciate your point of view. Thanks for calling in. Andy, what do you think of that? I mean, I know you're not a partisan necessarily in this debate, but this idea that making guns more readily available might not contribute to more gun violence.
I think the only partisan, the sort of partisanship I have is to argue that this does matter. I agree with the caller that 3D printers are cool and have a million, you know, productive and great uses. My job is to call attention to the, you know, the interesting and controversial side of these new tools. And yes, I do think that new tools matter. It's true that gun control barely exists in America, and especially in certain states. Cody Wilson describes his project in part, or even in mainly now, given the current, you know, administration, that as a preventative measure against future gun control. So, you know, even if the kind of resurgence of the gun control movement after the Parkland shooting earlier this year were to have some success and push through some kind of new gun control measures at the state or federal level, he sees what he's created as a kind of circumvention of that, you know, even if there are new gun control measures, there will be these tools to get around those. And I think that that's an important point, but also it's hard to predict, you know, as we look, you know, in the decades to come, as these tools get even cheaper and easier to use, that could actually substantially change people's access to guns in America and, you know, undo even the little bit of gun control that we do have in this country.
And let me introduce Avery Gardner. She's co-president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, which is a nonprofit. The group, along with Every Town for Gun Safety and the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, told a district judge in Texas this week that it will seek an injunction to block defense distributed from publishing blueprints for 3D guns online. Avery Gardner, welcome to On Point. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining me from Boulder, Colorado is David Koppel, an associate policy analyst at the Cato Institute. He's also research director for the Independence Institute, which has received contributions from the NRA, and he's an adjunct professor of constitutional law at Denver University. Dave Koppel, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Avery, I'd like to start with you, if I could. Your concern about this and what the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence is trying to do about this.
The idea that people can 3D print guns in their living rooms and avoid a background check means that it is very likely that we will have more guns in the hands of dangerous people in the United States. We already have an epidemic of gun violence. 96 people die from a gunshot every day in this country. And it makes very little sense, the notion that the government has decided to make it even easier for people we all have agreed are too dangerous to have guns, now to make them in their living rooms without going through any background check at all. It's ludicrous, and it has to be stopped.
What do you make of the rather intriguing argument that Cody Wilson successfully presented, making this really about First Amendment? That is, this is about access to information, not necessarily access to guns.
Anthony, I have to disagree with your characterization. He did not successfully make that argument. He attempted that argument, and the district court judge in Texas disagreed and denied his preliminary injunction request. He appealed that to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and again, the government prevailed. Then in March, the government filed a motion to dismiss his entire case, saying that there wasn't anything that was legally cognizable here and that the case should be dismissed by the judge. And while that was pending, the Trump administration had a sudden change of heart and caved. So there was no ruling by a court that there was any merit to this notion that the First Amendment somehow means you have a right to say anything at all, no matter how much danger it would put the American people in. That's just not consistent with the law, and it was not what happened in this case.
Hmm. So where do we stand now? I mean, what leverage do you have to try to turn this around? Tell me what you are doing and trying to make happen.
Well, what happened in this case was a sudden change of heart and settlement by the government. And they announced that just very recently and said that the case would be voluntarily dismissed in early August. And Cody Wilson has said he's going to put all of his plans online on the 1st of August. Now, just after we heard that news, we filed a request with the government, both the Department of Justice and the Department of State, to share with us the documents that led them to this sudden change. But under the statutory deadlines, we're not likely to get those documents until after August 1st. So we don't know what has caused this settlement to happen at this point. Again, why did the government change its mind after winning year after year after year in this case? So what we notified the judge of yesterday is that we intend to file papers, hopefully tomorrow, in his court, saying that we want the right to participate in this litigation and that we will seek a request for immediate injunctive relief. And to de-lawyer that for a minute, that means we'll be asking the judge to block this settlement from going into effect, at least temporarily, until we get more answers about why. You know, a couple of years ago, the State Department, as Andy described, thought that the publication of these blueprints online was a threat to national security. And the American public has a right to know what facts have changed that have led the government to decide and determine that that no longer exists as a threat.
Right. David Koppel, let me bring you into this conversation. What's your take on what Cody Wilson has achieved, at least for now, here? Is this a good thing? Does it make sense to you in terms of a legal argument?
Well, I think it makes no difference, because if you actually read the briefs in the case, which I did, the State Department in this case made it very clear. You can see that Cody Wilson's not the only guys doing it. There are nine other companies, and the State Department prevented his company only from posting stuff on the Internet. All the others are there, as our guest from Wired talked about in 2016, while Cody Wilson's company was prevented from uploading things on the Internet. Plenty of other companies could do it, and they still can, and they still do. And the position of the U.S. government during the Obama administration was it is perfectly legal to sell or distribute for free these kinds of CAD designs, diagrams, blueprints, and things like that. Their only objection was that if Cody Wilson, although not the other guys, if he posted on the Internet, then some foreigner could see it and they could download it. It was based on their alleged authority under the Arms Control Export Act. So this stuff is already out there. When the Cody Wilson stuff was up there for a few days, it was downloaded 100,000 times. So it's all the information's out there, and in a practical matter, nothing's going to change on August 1st. And to answer the question on why did the administration change its position on the case, well, the answer is the underlying law was different. The Obama administration had adopted the position that the Arms Control Export Act, which applies to military weapons, they said that can apply to all ordinary firearms, a revolver, for example. And they said, well, so since revolver exports are part of the Arms Control Export Act, in their view, then therefore Cody Wilson can't put the design for a revolver up on the Internet.
Dave Koppel, hold that thought. I'm going to pick up with you after the break. I'm sorry, but we're coming up on a break. Listeners, you can join the conversation. Do you worry about who might have access to 3D printed weapons? You can join this conversation. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
The There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the right to bear 3D printed arms. You can join the conversation. Do you worry about who might have access to 3D printed weapons, about guns without serial numbers being used by people without background checks? My guests today are Andy Greenberg, staff writer for Wired, Avery Gardner, co-president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, and David Koppel, associate policy analyst at the Cato Institute and research director for the Independence Institute. Dave Koppel, I want to come back to you because I know I cut you off before the break, but let me just read you a comment and engage you on this question. Here's a comment from Karen on our website. How could this technology be good for anyone but criminals and gun nutters? Don't we already have enough guns in this country? And Dave, I wonder if you could sort of speak to Avery's concern that this is going to make weapons available to all kinds of people without background checks at any time. Isn't that a concern?
It has always been legal in this country to manufacture your own firearm for your own personal use. That was the law in 1791. It was the law in 1650. And it's always been the same today. The technology's changed, but the law hasn't.
But doesn't the technology that makes it so much easier and so much more accessible need to be taken into consideration? I mean, this is why regulations are put into effect, to keep up with technology. I mean, that's one of the reasons.
Sure, but we've had this technology on the ground for years. Andy used it in 2016, and it doesn't seem to have changed things very much. We also have sort of a history in this country of getting overexcited about new technology things. In the Brady Center's brief in this case, they cited approvingly concerns about plastic guns that came up in 1986, and there was this big story that, Gaddafi, of the dictator of Libya, was trying to buy plastic guns, and so we have to have some law against about plastic guns. Well, as it turned out, he was buying Glock pistols, which are partly made from plastic using polymers.
Well, Dave, let me let Avery respond.
Pistols around.
Yeah, Avery Gardner, Brady Center. Are you folks getting overexcited about this?
I don't think anybody could say that there's overexcitement on this issue. This is a real threat, and it's a threat both domestically, which we've been talking about so far, but it's also a threat abroad. And I want to just read you something very briefly that was in the government's brief this spring, so this April, meaning it was the Trump administration who was saying this. And they said, I quote, "At issue in this litigation is the United States' ability to control the export of weapons." And it continues on, "where beyond the reach of U.S. law, they could be used to threaten U.S. national security, U.S. foreign policy interests, or international peace and stability." That's what the Trump administration believed, and I agree with that statement, that in addition to all of the concerns about people who shouldn't have guns 3D printing them in their living rooms, we've got to worry about what's going to happen outside of our nation's borders. Mm. What's happening with state sponsors of terrorism on this issue?
I want to take some calls from our listeners. We've got a bunch of them lined up. Let's go to Bob, who's calling from Boulder, Colorado. Bob, it's good to have you. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I just think this is awesome. I think it is a pardon the pun, but it's a shot in the arm for the Second Amendment. And I think with the milling machines cost and the 3D printer cost, obviously it will go down over the years. I think the more weapons that are produced, the better. One thing too is the people that claim that they're invisible for X-ray, they're not being honest, because the ammunition is metal. So we put the gun allegedly invisible and then load a magazine in it, and it's a magazine, not a clip. If you're like Ms. Gardner, she won't know the difference. But load a magazine, and it's going to be showing up on X-ray. And so that's kind of a very spurious notion to begin with.
Got it, Bob, and I appreciate your point of view. Bob, they're talking about this as a shot in the arm for the Second Amendment, and we'll get to that. I want to take one more call in this period, so let's go to David, who's calling from Clearwater, Florida. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello, Anthony.
Hey, David.
Avery and David. So we seem to be disregarding the fact that we have a serious economic impact on the gun industry in this country as a result of the freebies on the web. And they haven't spoken yet. I would think that there could be something that they would and could do to try to prevent this, not in the front end, but in the back end, perhaps by a change in some kind of taxation of this sort of gun. And
David, it's an interesting point, and let me put it to Andy Greenberg. Andy, what do you think of that? I mean, have gun manufacturers chimed in on what they think about a potential explosion in do-it-yourself gun manufacturing?
You know, they haven't very much, and neither has the NRA. Interestingly, Defense Distributed and the NRA are often at odds, and Cody Wilson loves to attack the NRA. I think he sees what he's doing as certainly adversarial to traditional gun manufacturers. The NRA has been so silent on this issue that it seems like they must see it in the same light, given that they are essentially a gun industry group. So, you know, I do find it weird that the NRA has not chimed in. I imagine that they think that any press for 3D printed guns is good press, and that they therefore don't want to, you know, raise the possibility in the mainstream, you know, the mainstream media that you can create your own gun and therefore lessen gun sales. But that's just a guess.
Interesting. Dave Koppel, what do you think about that? Why the NRA hasn't chimed in on this one?
You'd have to ask them. That's their decision. The broader point is, what was at issue here was much more of a, and if you read the briefs, it's much more of a, it is a more of a First Amendment case than a Second Amendment case. And that's why groups like the Reporters Committee for the Free Press, for Freedom of the Press, which is not a gun group, it's a free press group, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, also a First Amendment group, wrote amicus briefs saying that the government's position here, in the, fortunately now abandoned, is a tremendous threat to reporting of legal technical data about all kinds of issues. For example, the government's position was that if you publish technical data, not secret stuff, but technical data about a whole variety of things, well, that's okay. You can do it in the public domain, like at a speech at a university conference or in a journal. But if you publish it on the internet, somehow that's not in the public domain, according to the government's theory, and that actually just posting something on an internet server in the United States is actually export, which is very contrary to the normal meaning of the word and contrary to the statute, and is a prior restraint on the freedom of the press. And the Reporters Committee for the Freedom of the Press said this government theory would give the government the unilateral ability, without judicial review, to censor all kinds of things. And one specific thing they pointed to was something that Declan McCullough wrote about for CNET.com about how U.S. drones overseas, military ones, may be having technology being put into them that could be used for domestic surveillance. And they said that's exactly the kind of thing that, if you follow the government's arguments here, that the State Department would have the unilateral ability to censor. So
I get it.
We haven't changed the Second Amendment much, but this was a new development in the case is a big win for the First Amendment.
Avery Gardner, I want to ask you about that, because my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that one of the things that Cody Wilson was arguing, that this is similar to the fight over free encryption to thwart surveillance. In the 1990s, encryption software was treated as a weapon, it was prohibited, but that policy was challenged with the argument that this was about information, free speech. And he argued that this is a similar situation. We're talking about data. We're not necessarily talking about guns.
Well, one of the real travesties in this situation is that we've actually had very little factual or legal record developed in this case. Mm-hmm. So there has been no trial. There have been only one set of briefs that the judge ruled on in this case. And when we come to the very thorny issues of trying to decide what are the boundaries of the First Amendment and the Second Amendment, what we have in this country is a system where we work through the courts and we work through judges. I think that the government would have prevailed in this case because reasonable restrictions on the First Amendment are upheld all the time, right? You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. That puts people at risk. You may have the right to petition the government for redress of grievances, right? You can go have a protest if you're unhappy with the government, and a lot of people have been doing that in the last few months. But you can't just do it any old time and place you want. You have to get a permit. So we have, for decades, in fact centuries, upheld reasonable restrictions on First Amendment rights, and the same thing is true of the Second Amendment. But what is supposed to happen in our system of an organized court structure is that those cases work their way through the courts and that there is briefing and judges consider the views of experts and they have facts in front of them and a well-developed record and make a decision and then the appeals courts review it. That was short-circuited here because the government did this about-face and hasn't shared with the people of America any reason as for why it did, what facts have changed, or why it abandoned its case here. So that's one of the issues that I think people are kind of losing sight of. This settlement is not a win or a loss for the First Amendment or a win or a loss for the Second Amendment. It's a settlement made behind closed doors that makes one case go away. It has no precedential effect, and it's not binding on anybody. So I think people are overstating the case when they say this is a sea change for either of those amendments. It's simply a settlement in one case, a settlement that puts us all at risk, no doubt, but a settlement indeed.
Let's go to Bob, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Bob, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, Anthony. Well, in regards to the First or Second Amendment, of course, you have to look at the potential harm. I mean, under the 1968 Gun Control Act, it does require a serial number on any gun that's manufactured in the country. So if you're going to do it legally, I guess you have to get yourself a serial number after you manufacture it, and therefore it can be traceable. As far as for the criminals, they're not going to get the software, the printer, and the milling machine to make their own guns. They're going to get it from the black market where they've always gotten their guns. And as far as kids doing it, well, where are the parents as far as supervision? Now, the last point I'd make is the national security issue that came up on it, the arming of ISIS or other radicals. Well, it is a national security issue because since the United States is the largest exporter of firearms in the world, we certainly wouldn't want to cut in on any of the money that the big manufacturers of guns can make. And the fact of the matter is, look at our own policy as far as the radicals that were once our friend, we armed. They're using those arms against us now. So I think there's a lot of ballyhoo about nothing on this case.
Bob, you put a lot on the table, and I want to actually go to Andy Greenberg on one of the points you made that I thought was really interesting. I mean, I thought a lot of it was interesting, but Andy, speak to this issue. I mean, Bob was talking there about the software, the milling machine, the expense, some of the technical know-how. I mean, it's not as though you can just download this, on your on your iPad and boom, you've got a gun. Talk about the expense and what's actually involved in producing a gun.
Can I first just respond to another thing that Bob said? He said that you have to put a serial number on your homemade weapon for it to be legal, but that's not actually true in most of America. You can own a so-called, people call these ghost guns.
That's right.
With no serial number, only in California now, and I think potentially in New Jersey, I'm not sure, but definitely in California, do you have to add that serial number for it to be legal? But to respond to the other question, I see this as a story about the future. You know, nobody used to think that people would buy drugs off the dark web when you can just buy them on a street corner or something, right? But then the Silk Road, if you've heard of that, this dark web drug market came along and became a $1 billion bazaar for every kind of contraband imaginable on the web. You know, criminals do adopt technology. Sometimes it's not immediate. Sometimes it takes some streamlining of the, you know, the user interface, but it happens. And I see that evolution happening with guns as well. Maybe not today, but, you know, as these tools become easier and cheaper, it does seem like we're going in that direction.
All right. Let's get one last call into this hour. Roger is calling from Heartland, Vermont. Go ahead, Roger. Good to have you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Hi, Anthony. If transmission of the information to print a gun on a 3D printer is guaranteed by freedom of speech, why would this not lead to legally putting the code online eventually to build bombs, mines, anti-aircraft weapons, and in the extreme, nuclear weapons? This is the thin edge of the wedge argument.
Roger, thanks so much for that. Dave Koppel, respond to Roger. I mean, is this the thin edge? What about that? Instructions online to build weapons, mines, bombs, so on and so forth.
You can buy books on those right now, and it's legal to upload a book to the internet. That's the way it's always been throughout American history in terms of law. What changed, to answer the woman from the Brady Center's question.
Avery Gardner is with us. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. What changed in the law was the Trump administration followed through on something that was begun under the Obama administration, which was to say, we now accept that many types of ordinary firearms, you know, when you pull the trigger once, you get one shot, not machine guns, not super large caliber guns. Of course, we're still going to have export laws about them, but they're not going to be covered by the specific laws that deal with military firearms. And since we now recognize they're not on the military arms list, then we therefore have no basis to say that the laws about military arms exports mean we can somehow prevent posting on the internet mere diagrams or pictures or instructions about those arms.
Got it, Dave Koppel. Avery Gardner, we're almost out of time. I want to give you the last word here. Respond to Dave if you'd like.
I'd just say that what Cody has told us he's going to put up on the internet is not just single-shot pistols. He has said he's putting weapons blueprints of all sorts, including for AR-15s, and that he hopes that this is going to serve as a searchable, user-generated database for practically any firearm imaginable. So it's simply not true that this is only about one kind of gun that wouldn't be a very practical use. This is a serious threat to all of us.
Avery Gardner, co-president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, thanks very much for joining us today. We appreciate it. And Dave Koppel, Associate Policy Analyst at the Cato Institute and Research Director for the Independence Institute. Dave Koppel, thank you as well. I'm very grateful for your time today.
Thank you.
Andy Greenberg, Senior Writer for Wired. He covers security, privacy, information freedom, and hacker culture. Andy, thanks so much for putting this article in front of us and the great work on it. We really appreciated having you today.
Thanks, Anthony.
Listeners, that's it. You can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.